Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, August 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Sarah Gordo's daily COVID-19 update. Childcare options still available. Data snapshot for Monday, August 24th. 56,585 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 717 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 530 total recovered in Cerro Gordo. 187 total active cases in Cerro Gordo. 1,040 deaths in Iowa. 20 deaths in Cerro Gordo. 14,602 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. Childcare options are still available. With schools around our communities returning to session, it is important to know that, if you are struggling with childcare, there are options. Consultants with Iowa Child Care Resource and Referral, or ICCRR, can refer parents to programs and providers that are most likely to meet their specific needs. Whether you are unsure if you can afford childcare, where to find childcare in your area, need supplemental childcare, or have other questions, ICCRR can help you along the way. For more information, visit iowaccrr.org/families. To speak with a consultant, call 855-244-5301. Phone lines are open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Or email the parent referral team at childcare@caeiowa.org. Positive COVID cases in Cerro Gordo above 700 now, deaths at 20. Over the weekend of July 24th, confirmed cases for COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo County went above 500 total. A little more than 2.5 weeks later, that number climbed above 600 confirmed positive cases for the virus in the county. 12 days later, with still a week to go in August, the figure for Cerro Gordo is now above 700 cases, with an average positive rate over the past 14 days of 5.8%. At the same time that total confirmed cases in Cerro Gordo have risen by 200 in the span of a month, deaths have ticked up as well, but not anywhere close to the same rate. When August began, there were 17 deaths from COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. With a week left in the month, there are now 20 deaths from the virus, which is significantly less than data reporting from July when the county went from 1 COVID-19 death to 17. Both of those upticks come in a month where the state as a whole reached the tragic milestone of 1,000 deaths from COVID-19. The milestone was reported by state public health data on the morning of August 19th, almost 5 months after the first death of the global pandemic was recorded here. Since that first reported death in Iowa, the state over the course of the pandemic has averaged 6.7 new deaths reported per day, according to state public health data compiled by the Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's COVID-related deaths, hospitalizations, and new cases all peaked in May, then dropped through late June. But statewide, all of those trend lines have been steadily increasing in the 2 months since. New cases and hospital admissions have surged to near their previous peaks. Locally, it's been a downward trend from the highs seen in July, enough that the average positive rate is more than 2% off of the long-standing rate of 7.9%. As that positive rate has dipped, so too have the active cases. Where there once was a stretch that active cases were keeping pace with recovered cases, there are now 511 recoveries to 181 active cases. That 5.8% two-week trend matters a great deal with schools now getting back in session. Governor Kim Reynolds has said that schools with a 15% positivity rate, a threshold 3 times higher than recommended by many public health experts, can apply for a waiver to start the year online. Otherwise, districts must offer at least 50% in-person instruction. The Mason City Community School District has opted for a hybridized approach, with precisely 50% of learning coming in person and the other 50% coming online. Iowa confirms first child death from COVID as schools reopen. A young child died due to complications from coronavirus in June, the first confirmed death of a minor in Iowa during the pandemic, the state health department belatedly announced Sunday evening. The Iowa Department of Public Health said the state medical examiner's office concluded its case investigation August 6th into the death of the child, who was under the age of 5. But the death wasn't reported in the state's statistics until Saturday, more than 2 weeks later. The child's death was publicly reported this weekend after ensuring the individual's identity would remain protected and notifying the family, the department said in a statement. We have made every effort to protect the identity of this child while the family grieves this devastating loss. Again, we send our sincerest condolences. The confirmation of the state's first child death comes one day before dozens of school districts are prepared to begin the school year on Monday, a development that has many educators and parents already on edge. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has ordered schools to reopen for at least 50% in-person instruction, despite a pandemic that has already killed 1,036 people and seen infections soar in recent days. Reynolds has said that the majority of school districts will resume classroom instruction this week. Some districts have delayed their start dates until September because of coronavirus concerns or the August 10 derecho that damaged many school buildings. Two of the largest, Iowa City and Des Moines, and the State Teachers Union are pursuing legal action challenging the governor's authority to order schools to offer in-person instruction during the pandemic. They say it's simply unsafe for now and that local school boards can better make decisions about when to return. Nearly 90% of people who have died after contracting coronavirus in Iowa have been 61 or older, and a majority were living in nursing homes with outbreaks, according to state data. In all, about 20 people under the age of 40 have died from the virus since March. The confirmation of the child's death came a day after the Associated Press asked for information about the first person under age 17 that was reported on the state's coronavirus website Saturday. The statement said that the medical examiner performed a full range of testing on the child, as is routine for any individual who dies under the age of 17. Other tests were performed given the child's health history as a complicating factor. Ultimately, COVID-19 was deemed the cause of death, the statement said. The department didn't immediately release any additional information, including the child's county of residence or gender. Public Health Department spokeswoman Amy McCoy told the AP on Saturday she would look into questions, but never responded before the department issued Sunday night's statement. Reynolds was asked at a news conference last week about McCoy's failure to respond to some media inquiries. The governor said that it was not her expectation that such inquiries would be ignored and promised to look into the concerns. The department's credibility took a hit last week after it acknowledged that thousands of positive and negative cases had been erroneously backdated due to a data error. The state medical director and epidemiologist, Caitlin Padotti, said she had been aware of the error since late July. Nonetheless, she allowed the department to release flawed county-by-county 14-day positivity rates on which schools and parents made decisions about reopening and enrollment. Those rates were changed Wednesday when the department claimed to fix the error, although independent trackers say they still see numerous discrepancies. Reynolds says that only districts where the positivity rate reaches 15%, a threshold three times higher than what's recommended by many public health experts, can apply for waivers to move to virtual learning for 2 weeks at a time. Five counties exceed that rate as of Sunday, but as of Friday, no waivers had been issued for districts to begin completely virtual. What to watch on opening night of the Republican National Convention? Joe Biden and his Democratic Party used their convention last week to argue that the underpinnings of American democracy hang in the balance this November. This week, it's President Donald Trump's turn. Republicans will renominate the president and highlight 4 years of the Trump administration and promises he delivered on, such as overturning business regulations, pulling out of international agreements, appointing 2 U.S. Supreme Court justices, and transforming the U.S. immigration system. While Democrats held an entirely virtual convention, pulled off without any major technical mishaps, the Republicans are holding a pared-down version of an in-person gathering on Monday in Charlotte, North Carolina. The convention runs through Thursday and includes a presidential speech from the White House South Lawn and a vice presidential address from Fort McHenry in Baltimore. The convention was originally scheduled to be held in Charlotte until Trump moved it to Jacksonville, Florida, with the hope the Republican-led state would allow thousands to attend. But Trump had to scrap that plan as coronavirus cases continued to climb. The GOP has planned for 6 delegates from each state and territory for a total of 336 to attend in-person proceedings for the convention's first day in Charlotte. They'll hold a roll call vote to renominate the president, but unlike the Democrats, it won't be a primetime affair. Instead, the voting will take place Monday morning with a recap shown during the evening's programming. Delegates will also vote on several resolutions, including measures defending October's Columbus Day holiday, which honors the polarizing 15th century explorer, and opposing cancel culture. The daytime business of the GOP delegates will be available starting at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the GOP convention's social media channels and AT&T UVerse, DirecTV, Twitch, YouTube, and Amazon Prime TV. The convention will continue streaming at those places when the primetime programming starts at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, a half hour earlier than the DNC convention, and runs through 11 p.m. Eastern Time. CNN, C-SPAN, MSNBC, and PBS will air the full primetime presentation, while ABC, CBS, Fox News Channel, and NBC will air the final hour from 10 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Trump gives a formal acceptance speech Thursday night from the South Lawn, but he's expected to make an appearance every night in the 10 p.m. Eastern hour. It's unclear to what extent he'll make remarks, but Monday's theme, Land of Promise, highlights how Trump helped renew the American dream. Speakers are likely to renew Trump's focus from last week, drawing contrasts with his Democratic opponent and portraying Biden as an ineffective career politician and a puppet of the radical left, aligning him with progressives like New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. While Democrats repeatedly mentioned the impact of the virus and hammered Trump's response to it, expect Republicans to defend the president on the issue but feature it less prominently. Republicans seen as potential 2024 presidential candidates are sprinkled throughout the week's proceedings. On Monday, 2 potential contenders from the Palmetto State will get their chance in the spotlight. Former Ambassador to the UN and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, followed by South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who is set to give the prominent closing speech. The Democratic Convention featured every living Democratic president and the party's 2004 presidential nominee, John Kerry. The Republican Party, transformed under Trump, is not expected to feature at its convention the only living GOP ex-president, President George W. Bush, or the party's 2012 nominee, Mitt Romney. Neither man voted for Trump in 2016 or has endorsed him this year. Postal Service adequately funded to handle mail-in voting surge, Grassley says. The U.S. Postal Service needs additional funding, but Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, doesn't expect the Senate to take up the $25 billion appropriation the House approved late last week. We need to give the post office more money, but none of this has anything to do with making sure that we are able to process the ballots, get the ballots to be counted, he told reporters Monday. That was a concern of the Democratic-controlled House when it passed the Delivering for America Act on Saturday to prohibit operational changes the majority party says have led to a slowdown in delivery times. Second District U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack called the slowdowns unacceptable because many Iowans, especially in rural areas, rely on the United States Postal Service to get their medical prescriptions, correspond with loved ones, receive important tax notifications and refunds from the IRS, vote by mail, and get their paychecks and many other packages and letters safely from one place to another. Democrats have accused the Postmaster General, who was appointed by President Donald Trump, of intentionally slowing services to delay mail-in ballots in November. However, in Senate testimony before the House approved the funding, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said his number one priority is to ensure election mail arrives on time. Trump has threatened to veto the legislation if it arrives on his desk. There seems to be little likelihood of that, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has called the bill part of a postal conspiracy theory. Democrats said preventing operational changes is necessary because millions of Americans are expected to vote by mail to avoid casting in-person ballots at polling places. The Postal Service called the House bill well-meaning, but said the legislation would constrain its ability to make changes to improve efficiency, reduce costs, and improve service. According to Grassley, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the Postal Service is adequately funded through August 2021. In addition, Congress approved an additional $10 billion. The current and previous Postmasters General have warned that in some states, election laws compress the absentee voting process to a point that it may be difficult for voters to apply for a ballot, receive it in the mail, and return it through the postal system in time to be counted, Grassley said. Iowa is not among those states, he added. Iowans can request an absentee ballot now and begin returning them October 5th, 29 days before the November 3rd election. Tony Evers, Mandela Barnes call for special session on police reform bills following shooting of Black Kenosha man. Sparked by the police shooting of a 29-year-old Black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin on Sunday, Wisconsin Democratic Governor Tony Evers has called for the legislature to meet in special session to take up a package of police reform bills introduced more than 2 months ago. Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes first introduced the 9 bills that would ban the use of chokeholds by Wisconsin police officers, as well as limit other uses of force, in June, following the death of another Black man, George Floyd, at the hands of Minnesota police officers. GOP leaders in the Wisconsin Assembly and Senate have not convened on the proposed legislation. We cannot wait for Republican leadership to show up for work because clearly they intend to keep us waiting, Evers said on a Monday video address. That's not going to cut it. On Sunday, Kenosha police shot 29-year-old Jacob Blake multiple times in front of his 3 children as he attempted to enter his SUV. Blake was hospitalized in serious condition. This is familiar violence to too many of us, especially those of us who are on the receiving end, said Barnes, who is Black. Evers signed an executive order on Monday calling for the special session to be held at noon on August 31st. Less than an hour before Evers and Barnes spoke, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican from Rochester, announced a task force focusing on racial disparities, educational opportunities, public safety, and police policies and standards. We have an opportunity to bring people together to find solutions, Voss said in a statement released after Evers called for the special session. Instead, the governor is choosing to turn to politics again by dictating liberal policies that will only deepen the divisions in our state. Some Democrats were quick to criticize Voss's comments, including Representative Daniel Reamer, a Democrat from Milwaukee, pointed out that Republicans have had 2 months to act on the package of police reform bills. The time for task forces on racial disparities has long passed, Reamer said in a tweet. It's time for actual action. Evers in June did not call for the legislature to convene in special session to take up the package, noting that previous attempts to force a vote in the past, such as gun control proposed by Democratic lawmakers last fall, have been ignored by the GOP-led Assembly and Senate. The legislature is not required to debate or vote on the bills. The package of bills would establish statewide use of force standards for all law enforcement agencies, identifying the use of deadly force as only allowable as a last resort, and that such use of force should be limited to the least amount of force necessary. Require officers to complete 8 hours of training on the use of force and de-escalation techniques annually. create a $1 million grant program administered by the Department of Justice to fund community organizations that work to mediate conflicts. Require law enforcement agencies to develop policies banning the use of chokeholds. Require law enforcement agencies to prepare policies for the use of force and make such policies publicly available. Put in statute a civil cause of action against unnecessarily calling police for the intent of infringing on a person's constitutional rights. Prohibit no-knock search warrants. Require additional training and hiring standards for police departments, jails, and juvenile detention centers. Voss said in a statement he was disturbed by the video showing Kenosha police shooting and wounding Blake, apparently in the back, while responding to a call about a domestic dispute. Voss also called on the Wisconsin Department of Justice Division of Criminal Investigation to meet the department's goal of completing an investigation in 30 days. The Kenosha community deserves to know the totality of the circumstances leading up to the shooting, Voss said in the statement. Before passing judgment, we have to know if the shocking 20-second video clip shared with the media tells the whole story. The officers involved in the incident have been placed on administrative leave, which is standard practice in a shooting by police, while the State Justice Department investigates. Voss also said he was deeply disturbed by the protests that followed Sunday's shooting and encouraged future protests to take place peacefully. Protesters set cars on fire, smashed windows, and clashed with officers in riot gear Sunday evening after the shooting. Protests in Madison left a few businesses on State Street with exterior damage. On Monday, Evers said the Wisconsin National Guard has deployed 125 members to protect infrastructure, first responders, and firefighters. This is not a time for political posturing or to suggest defunding law enforcement. When a community is hurting, the most important thing that we can do is to listen, Voss said. We must find a path forward as a society that brings everyone together. Wisconsin is considered one of the worst states in the nation for racial disparities between white and black communities in areas such as unemployment, incarceration rates, income, and education. Deere & Company reports third quarter results. Deere & Company reported a net income of $811 million for the fiscal quarter that ended August 2nd. That's $2.50 per share for the Moline-based ag and construction equipment manufacturer, compared to net income of $899 million, or $2.81 per share, for the quarter that ended July 28, 2019. Deere reported net income of $1.993 billion, or $6.30 per share, for the first nine fiscal months, compared to $2.532 billion, or $7.87 per share, for the same period a year ago. In May, the company had released a projected fiscal forecast that projected net income between $1.6 billion and $2 billion for the year, a revision from February's pre-coronavirus projection of $2.7 billion to $3.1 billion. As of Friday, Deere is projecting its yearly net income to fall between the two previous projections and reach about $2.25 billion, which could be impacted by the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. Worldwide net sales and revenues decreased 11% to $8.925 billion for the third quarter and declined 12% to $25.809 billion for the nine fiscal quarters. Net sales of the equipment operations were $7.859 billion for the quarter and $22.612 billion for 9 months, compared with $8.969 billion and $26.182 billion last year. With outstanding support from our dedicated global workforce and dealer organization, John Deere delivered a strong performance in the third quarter in the face of a serious global pandemic and uncertain market conditions, said John May, Deere's CEO and board chairman, in a news release. As we manage through the pandemic, Deere's number one priority continues to be safeguarding the health and well-being of its employees. Thanks to aggressive measures taken early in the crisis, we have had success keeping our employees safe, our factories and parts centers functioning, and our customers served. Company officials provided specifics on some of the steps taken this fiscal year as it embarks on a corporate reorganization, or what Deere has called its smart industrial redesign. Deere plans to spend $435 million this fiscal year on one-time moves, such as $138 million earlier this year for salaried employee buyouts and $175 million on salaried employee reductions. Other cost-saving measures include shutting down a small tractor manufacturing facility in China, a $37 million cost for the current fiscal year, and sold a lawnmower subsidiary, SABO Maschinenfabrik, in Europe. Those moves are projected to save about $260 million on an annual basis going forward. Officials have said they would be evaluating operations for months. The other aspect of the smart industrial redesign is a focused approach on its precision ag, or the use of technology by operators in their fields. In other words, Deere is moving to position itself as the Apple of ag. But that use of technology, such as having a sprayer turn off between plants instead of running the entire time, cuts overhead expenses for farmers. 2 years of international trade wars seemed to come to an end when the U.S. and China signed off on the first phase of a new trade deal in January, but the coronavirus leveled economic blows to both countries. China has increased purchases of American-made goods, such as crops, as promised in the deal, but still has a ways to go to meet goals. Corey Reed, president of Deere's Agriculture and Turf Division for Production and Precision Ag, said nearly all of the company's advanced precision features saw higher take rates by customers than previous years. That demonstrates customers' willingness for sustained investment in technology in the face of uncertain market conditions. Specifically, we see the significant levels of investment in solutions that have the highest demonstrable impact on customer economics, he said. Iowa GOP convention delegates on fire for Trump. Iowa Republicans are going into their national convention with a fire on board this Trump train, according to a longtime activist who is among the state party's 6 in-person delegates in Charlotte, North Carolina. "I have not seen this type of enthusiasm in quite some time," Republican Party of Iowa National Committee woman Tamara Scott said Sunday on a call from Charlotte, where the convention will kick off Monday. Unlike 2012, when supporters of nominee Mitt Romney and Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul had their differences, and in 2016, when not everyone had fully committed to Donald Trump, there is unity this year. Convention goers, including some Democrats, Scott said, want the economy back. They want their jobs back. They want the pay raises that they had with the wage increases he created. They want the tax deductions that he made better for their families. So when you understand what we had, remember what Iowa, what America had come through, and how he helped us make America great again. We understand he's the only one who can help us make America great again twice, Scott said. That doesn't mean that Republicans are in lockstep on every issue, but the one thing that we are is behind this president, said Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman. What's different about the convention are the safety precautions in place, Kaufman and other delegates in Charlotte said. I feel like we're in the safest place in the country right now, not just because of the Secret Service, but I've had 2 COVID tests. I've had my temperature taken every single day. I can't go anywhere without my armband showing that everything is healthy, Kaufman said. All kidding aside, I mean, we are following the CDC guidelines strictly. It's not fun, added David Barker from Iowa City, but it's a real commitment to safety. Our committee meetings are in enormous rooms with not a lot of people in them, separated by quite a bit, and hand sanitizer everywhere. Iowa has 40 national convention delegates, but because of COVID-19, each state is allowed to send 6 people. In addition to Kaufman, Scott, and Barker, the Iowa delegates are Anthony Marlowe, Cheryl Weishut, and National Committeeman Steve Scheffler. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will speak to the convention Tuesday, and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst will address the delegates Wednesday. Both will deliver their remarks from Iowa. With the enthusiasm and unity he's seeing, Kaufman doesn't expect any drama except for how long it will take each state delegation to say how wonderful Donald Trump is. he expects the convention to present a more positive message than the Democratic National Committee presented voters last week. You cannot win an election for the most powerful human being in the world by being against something, let alone not even a policy, but being against a personality, Kaufman said about the Democrats' not Trump message. I would argue that even the people that may not be huge fans of the president's personality want the alternative to be for something, he said. Kaufman characterized Democratic nominee former Vice President Joe Biden as a voice box for AOC and others on the progressive left, a reference to U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. The Trump-Biden race is an existential election between the president and a movement towards socialism, Kaufman said. One other difference Kaufman sees in Charlotte is how welcoming the party is of Iowans and the role Iowa plays in the nomination process. Unlike the Democratic National Committee chairman, Tom Perez, who called for an end to caucuses, I see absolutely no signs whatsoever that everybody doesn't hold the opinion of our president, which is things should start in Iowa, and there's no better grassroots way to do that than through holding a caucus, Kaufman said. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, August 24th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. At this time, we would traditionally turn to obituaries. As there are none today, we'll continue reading the news. Live monarch butterflies create unique display at Lime Creek Nature Center. A staple in the fields of prairie restoration, pollinator conservation, and entomology is the monarch butterfly. A jet black body with white spots, brilliant orange and black wings, and a graceful flight pattern, this insect plays an important role in its ecosystem and in our own practices of conservation. The monarch butterfly is a pollinator, responsible for the successful reproduction of many native flowers. In order to survive, it must first rely on a single genus of plants, milkweed. A common sight in prairies and roadside ditches, this plant is toxic to humans and most animals, but it is the only plant monarch caterpillars will eat before they become butterflies. It is this specialized diet and the species' overall importance that has led to Lime Creek Nature Center's newest project, a monarch rearing station. Located in the pollinator room, the rearing station consists of two mesh cages. The taller of the two is for the caterpillars, and the other is for the adult butterflies. Caterpillars start as eggs and hatch after about 3 days, then remain as caterpillars for 2 weeks. A chrysalis or pupa is formed for another 2 weeks, and then most adult butterflies will live for an additional 4 weeks. In the caterpillar cage, large caterpillars are able to eat milkweed until they climb up and hang from the cage ceiling. Soon after, they form a chrysalis. Once all of the caterpillars form a chrysalis, the lids are swapped on the two cages so new caterpillars can form their chrysalises and the old ones can emerge as butterflies. It is important to keep the old caterpillars separate from the new caterpillars, otherwise there is a risk of parasites being transferred. After about 2 weeks in the chrysalis stage, the adult butterflies are ready to come out. When they first emerge, their wings are crumpled and their bodies bloated. They have to spend the rest of the day pumping all of the fluid in their bodies into their wings so they can fly properly. The wings are also wet and need to dry off before the butterflies can fly properly. If all goes well, the butterflies can be released into the wild by the end of the day or the following morning. The caterpillars are usually much smaller when they arrive at the Nature Center. Of the over 50 specimens that have been successfully raised thus far, most were collected at Lime Creek's prairie just north of the parking lot. Nature Center staff either find them as eggs or caterpillars on the many milkweed plants found on the prairie. Eggs and small caterpillars are kept in small condiment containers by themselves until they are about an inch long. The lids have small holes poked in them to allow for air to get in, a milkweed leaf is provided for food or support, and a small moist piece of paper towel is put in as well to provide moisture. Later, they are put in a small plasticware container with a few other caterpillars until they are big enough to be put in the cage. Leaves and a larger moist paper towel are provided as well. Like the separate cages, the separate containers help prevent parasite transfer. Lime Creek tracks how many specimens are collected and how many make it to each life stage, ending in the release into the wild. Currently, Lime Creek has seen over 100 specimens come through its doors, but not all of the eggs and caterpillars have been successful. Parasites can threaten even captive caterpillars and monarchs. A microscopic parasite known as Ophrocystis electrocerera, OE for short, spreads quickly and prevents the adult's wings from developing properly. Another parasite, the larva of the tachinid fly, lives inside the caterpillar, slowly feeding off of it until it begins to form a chrysalis. From there, the larva bursts out in a move that is fatal to the caterpillar and chrysalis. To date, no caterpillars have been lost to OE, but a few have been victim to tachinid flies. When it comes to rearing monarchs, there are no guarantees. Sometimes things just go wrong, and a perfectly healthy caterpillar will not survive past the chrysalis stage. Towards the end of August, butterflies that are released from Live Creek will also be fitted with a tag. Monarch butterflies make a massive migration to Mexico each winter, and the tags help scientists keep track of the butterflies' general movements and how many actually survive the migration. The butterflies that make it to Mexico will overwinter before they begin back north. The migration back occurs in generations. The first generation will arrive in Texas and raise the next generation, which goes further north to do the same thing. Roughly two generations pass by the time the butterflies arrive in Iowa. This magnificent phenomenon, combined with the service of pollination that they provide for us, is why Lime Creek has dedicated this summer and future summers to helping keep the monarch population healthy. Lime Creek encourages visitors to come out and see the monarch rearing station for themselves. For those who would like more information on monarchs, as well as ways to get involved, monarchwatch.org is the site of Monarch Watch, a program based at the University of Kansas. Information can also be found at monarchmania.com, the site for Monarch Mania, a program within Cerro Gordo County. These websites also provide information for individuals interested in tagging monarchs themselves. Lime Creek appreciates the support in this new program and looks forward to the start of the migration. Hometown hockey. Mason City native Nick Howell tries to earn spot on North Iowa Bulls. A lot of sports fans grow up with childhood dreams of someday playing for their hometown teams. Mason City's Nick Howell might just get to do it. This past weekend, Howell played as a member of the North Iowa Bulls Red Team during the organization's preseason tryouts and made it through the first round of cuts as it works to set its roster for the upcoming season. Howell, a senior at Mason City High School, has had a longtime relationship with the Bulls franchise. The team has been able to keep a close watch over the Mason City native in his time playing for the Mohawks hockey team, and Howell has spent time practicing with the Bulls when his school schedule allows for the past several years. "I've been here for 10 years, and Nick has grown up in the Mohawk program," Bulls head coach Todd Sandin said. "We saw him at the rink when he was a little tiny guy. We've known Nick for a long time, and he is not a surprise to us." Howell has been playing hockey since he was around 4 or 5 years old. He began to play in Mason City with the Mohawks youth program and also played on a youth team called the Iowa Storm. Around the age of 11, Howell started attending North Iowa games at the Bulls' old home at North Iowa Ice Arena, affectionately dubbed the Barn by area hockey fans. "It was a little bit later when I was growing up, I started going to Bulls games because I couldn't really comprehend much when I was a little bit younger," Howell said. "Now I can watch my position and study the game, what's going on, and how to play." Over the past several years, Howell has proven to be a valuable piece on the ice for the Mohawks. In his time as a varsity player, Howell has scored 43 total goals and contributed 26 assists. Last season, Howell scored 28 goals in 31 games played. "He's a big, strong, and young hockey player who plays the game with speed," Sandin said. "He is a strong kid, so he has the aspect of being able to be physical as well. He understands our expectations. He lives in town, and he's on the ice with us regularly, so there is probably less grooming that we have to do with a player like Nick than a fresh incoming player." On Friday, Howell and his teammates on the Red Team took the ice against Bowman Hockey. On Saturday, the squad played two games, the first at noon against the Kenai River Brown Bears and again at 8:45 p.m. against the Sheridan Hawks. The weekend finished up with a game between the Bulls' red and green teams on Sunday afternoon. The weekend was full of chippy play on the ice with lots of pushing and shoving, and nearly every player got checked into the boards at some point in the day. While there was plenty of rough play, fights are kept to a minimum during the tryout season. Nobody wants to get a bad reputation, even if fighting is one of the players' favorite parts of the game. I think it's an unwritten rule that you don't fight because you are just there to get looked at, Howell said. If you fight, they think maybe this kid is just a goon. But some teams want that goon on the second line that can beat some other people up if they touch their skill players. I have a cage or helmet on, and I still have a cage on this year, so I won't be able to fight at all. It's kind of a bummer. The biggest bummer of the year for the Bulls came back on March 13th. The team finished the 2019-2020 regular season with a 38-7-2 record, won the NA3HL West title for the seventh time in its nine-year existence, and was all set to play Alexandria in the Fraser Cup playoffs when the league canceled the remainder of the postseason due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After a several-month layoff, Sandin and his coaching staff have finally been able to get back to recruiting and getting things ready for a new season. The league has not yet announced this year's schedule, but it is tentatively scheduled to begin sometime in early October. It's probably been a 6 to 8 week stretch that we have been able to go move about and scout and recruit kids, Sandin said. Having it down there at the Mason City Multipurpose Arena and having fans be able to come in and have a bunch of hockey players coming in and playing the game they love, it was a lot of fun this weekend. With the first round of tryouts done, Sandin said that 36 prospects, including Howell, have been invited to return. The roster will need to be trimmed even further before the season starts and will remain fluid until teams finalize their playoff rosters on February 10th. For Howell, there is still plenty more work to do. Even for a local kid who has a good relationship with the coaching staff, a spot is not guaranteed. That said, Sandin admits that the team would love to see Howell suit up in a North Iowa Bulls uniform if he proves deserving of a roster spot. If he is able to do that, certainly, Sandin said. It's always a competitive environment. We're not just going to put a guy in a jersey. They have to be able to contribute. With us extending practice time to him the last few years, he is a guy we are interested in trying to get in that jersey. Belmont Clemmie cancels football opener against West Fork amid positive COVID-19 results. The Belmont Clemmie football team has canceled its first game of the season and has been put into quarantine as multiple team members tested positive for COVID-19, Superintendent Dan Frazier has confirmed. We really can't talk about individuals, but there were multiple individuals on the team that tested positive, Frazier said. The news comes just 4 days before the Broncos were scheduled to play at West Fork in the football season opener. The district was one of the few in the state that chose not to hold a summer sports season due to a May outbreak of COVID-19 in Wright County. According to Frazier, the team is eligible to return to football activities on September 1st. The West Fork Athletic Program announced the cancellation on Monday morning in a tweet. As of now, the program is searching for a new opponent, but with just 4 days, odds are the Warhawks will just lose out on playing week one. We're still looking, West Fork Athletic Director Alex Brayton said. If that is going to happen, we'd like to make that decision as soon as humanly possible. I'm afraid that we're not the only school in this situation, being a Monday and places getting test results. Maybe we'll hear of a couple other schools in the same situation as us that lost an opponent, and we'd look to maybe link up with somebody if it made logistical sense. It would have to be pretty quick here for us to be able to turn around and be able to play on Friday. West Fork's next game is scheduled for September 4th at Hampton Dumont Cal. Belmont Clemmie's Week 2 game will come at home against Lake Mills. Bob Jensen, guest columnist, Fishing in the Midwest. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, summer of 2020 is already starting to exit. There are lots more butterflies on the bushes, birds are gathering, and football practice has started. And many anglers are spooling up with fresh line to prepare for fall fishing. I've often said that June and October are my favorite months for fishing. June 2020 is in the past. October 2020 is in the near future. Following are some things that I've experienced in autumn's past that will help anglers catch more fish in autumn's future. In the 80s, I had the good fortune to work at a fishing school in Walker, Minnesota called Camp Fish. Camp Fish hosted what they called Camp Fish Celebrity Jamborees. These jamborees were 2 to 3 days of hardcore fishing. Anglers visited camp and were taken fishing by notable guides, fishing celebrities, and tournament anglers. The jamborees were fundraisers and were held in the fall for several reasons, with one of those reasons being the fishing for a variety of fish species was best and most consistent then. On one memorable day, my boat partners and I caught dozens of largemouth bass using crankbaits along deep weed lines and on spinnerbaits in shallow rushes in the morning. In the afternoon, we moved to a different lake and caught a bunch of walleyes on jigs in a narrow area between lakes. We would have been very challenged to have that much diversity with that much success at any other time of year. In the fall, fish want to eat. They instinctively know that things are changing and they need to fatten up. They'll be wherever the food is. I recall a sunshiny October afternoon when we caught walleyes in 2 feet of water. They were on a windblown point that attracted bait fish. Typically, walleyes aren't that shallow when the sun is bright, but fall is different. The sun isn't as directly overhead in most of walleye country, and wind will diminish the negative effect of sunlight to some extent. And the presence of food in the fall will really encourage fish to participate in the catching part of fishing. Casting 1/16-ounce jigs to hungry walleyes in 2 feet of water is fun. I remember fishing for muskies with my friend Don Persh on Leech Lake one autumn afternoon a good number of years ago. We had been fishing for several hours with minimal action. I was ready to call it a day, but Don said that a major was coming soon. The major was a major sol-lunar period, and some anglers pay a lot of attention to these. Perhaps more anglers should pay attention to them. Don wanted to be on his best spot when the major arrived. We were, and so were the muskies. In just a couple of hours, we saw and hooked more fish than we had in the previous several hours. Some very successful anglers believe that major solunar periods have the most impact on fish in the fall months. Last thing, smallmouth bass gather more than usual in the fall. Just a couple of years ago, Mike Frisch and I joined Tim Snyder on Cabotagama Lake in northern Minnesota. Tim told us that the smallmouth fishing can be very, very good in the fall. Some fisher people exaggerate. Tim wasn't. We caught smallmouth after smallmouth on jigs and drop shot rigs tipped with KVD Dream Shot and half-shell plastics. Absolutely the best smallmouth action that I've ever experienced for quality and quantity. Spend time looking for the concentrations of fish in the fall, and chances are they'll bite. It appears that the fall of 2020 will be somewhat unusual, just like the spring and summer of 2020 have been. The good thing is, the fish don't know about that. They'll be where they usually are, doing what they usually do in the next few weeks. If you're where they are and doing what they want, you can get in on some memorable fishing action. Campaign Almanac, a roundup of campaign news items of interest for Monday, August 24th, 2020. In the spotlight, Iowans, regardless of their political affiliation, should be proud that U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and Governor Kim Reynolds will deliver remarks to the Republican National Committee National Convention this week, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said. It seems like Iowa is going to get a pretty good spotlight with Governor Reynolds and Senator Ernst speaking, he said. We should be very proud, not only as Republicans, but as Iowans, that we get two big-timers speaking on national television. After 5.5 years in the Senate, Ernst can speak to the triumphs of Trump, and not just triumphs as victories, but also probably promises he made in the campaign and promises he carried out, Grassley said. Reynolds, who is scheduled to speak Tuesday, can speak to how Trump has worked on making sure that ethanol gets the particular treatment that the law requires. Their presence speaks a great deal about their leadership and breaking glass ceilings, he said. Ernst is Iowa's first female member of Congress, and Reynolds is the state's first female governor. The fact they are speaking at the convention tells about how Iowa is going to have a voice in the next 4 years of the Trump administration, he said. He he won't be attending the convention, but said Monday he'll be watching as much as he can when he's not conducting his county town hall meetings. You're rehired. Republican National Committee Delegate Anthony Marlowe of Iowa City made a play on one of Donald Trump's signature lines in casting the Republican Party of Iowa's 40 votes for the president's renomination Monday. The delegation, represented by Marlowe and five others who are in Charlotte, North Carolina, cast all of its votes for Trump. The great state of Iowa fully sends all of our votes to renominate you to lead our country under God for 4 more years, the Iowa City businessman said. Mr. President and Mr. Vice President, you're rehired. Marlowe also thanked the president for his swift, decisive, and continued action in record speed in responding to the August 10th derecho. Iowa Republican signs anti-Trump letter. Jim Leach, an Iowa Republican who served 15 terms in the U.S. House, was one of the more than 70 Republican former national security officials and U.S. House members who signed a letter endorsing Democrat Joe Biden for president. The letter says the GOP former officials believe Trump has demonstrated that he lacks the character and competence to lead this nation and has engaged in corrupt behavior that renders him unfit to serve as president. The letter's signees were national security officials under Republican presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, or Donald Trump, or served in Congress. Leach represented Eastern Iowa's 2nd Congressional District from 1977 to 2007. First District Debate. Iowa 1st District U.S. House candidates Abby Finkenauer and Ashley Hinson will meet in an Iowa PBS debate on Labor Day. Finkenauer, a Cedar Rapids Democrat seeking a second term, and Iowa Representative Ashley Hinson, a Marion Republican, will meet at 8 p.m. on September 7th in the Iowa PBS Maytag Auditorium in Johnston. The live debate will air on Iowa PBS and live stream on iowapbs.org, YouTube, and Facebook. Due to current social distancing guidelines, there will be no studio audience and no media access to the Iowa PBS studios during the debate. Iowa Press host David Yepsen will moderate the debate. He will be joined by Radio Iowa News Director Kay Henderson and James Lynch of the Gazette. Patrol. 3 killed, 2 injured in Central Iowa wrong-way crash. 3 people, including a child, died in a crash in central Iowa's Hardin County, the Iowa State Patrol said Monday. The crash happened around 7:30 p.m. Sunday on U.S. Highway 20 near Alden, when a pickup truck traveling the wrong way crashed into the sport utility vehicle carrying 2 adults and a child, the Des Moines Register reported. Killed in the crash were 44-year-old Christy Gutierrez, who was driving, Mario Zubia, 38, and Jesse Gutierrez, 11, according to the patrol. All were from Story City. A 6-year-old child in the SUV was flown to a Des Moines hospital with serious injuries, investigators said. The wrong-way driver, Spencer Boltman, 25, of Hampton, was injured and taken to a local hospital, officials said. Throngs of UI students at Iowa City bars raise alarm. University of Iowa students in several bars in Iowa City are facing criticism after throngs of young adults were seen crowded together outside and within the venues, most without masks, just hours before in-person classes were to start Monday at the university and many Iowa K-12 schools. Iowa City police took a complaint just after 1 a.m. Sunday that several bars were all over capacity and not enforcing a mask mandate, the Gazette reported. A reporter with the Gazette also checked several bars around midnight and confirmed that most did not appear to be enforcing social distancing inside or mask wearing ordered by Iowa City's mayor. The scene came only a day after university officials issued a campus message reminding students to wear face coverings in accordance with city and county mandates and to keep at least 6 feet apart when possible. News of the unruly scenes came as the Iowa Department of Public Health reported 471 new known coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours as of Monday morning. The state reported a total of 56,584 confirmed cases and 1,039 deaths, including 5 from Sunday to Monday, since the outbreak began. Hospitalizations and patients admitted to intensive care also have been trending upward this month, the department's online virus portal shows. Woman killed in Western Iowa crash was Omaha teacher. A woman killed in a Western Iowa crash last week was an Omaha elementary school educator, officials said. Kathy Vasquez, 56, of Omaha, was killed in the Friday evening crash in Crescent, television station KETV reported. Pottawatomie County investigators said Vasquez was driving northbound along Old Lincoln Highway when an oncoming car crossed the center lane and hit her car head-on. Vasquez was rushed to an Omaha hospital where she was pronounced dead. Vasquez was a special education paraprofessional at Saddlebrook Elementary School in Omaha. The driver of the other car, a 21-year-old man from Omaha, also was injured and taken to an Omaha hospital, investigators said. Sheriff's officials said they were investigating whether speed and alcohol use factored into the crash. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Monday, August 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.